He had no illusions. If the SS had good reason to link Gudrun to the leaflets, to the Valkyries, it was unlikely she would be able to hold out for long. There were plenty of ways to make someone suffer without ever laying a finger on them, and try to say as little as possible when they ask questions.
"I'll try,"
Gudrun said. She took a nervous breath.
"Do your parents think you should get married?"
Horst blinked in surprise. "That's an odd question," he said finally. "They do want me to find a nice girl and move back east, but I don't think I want to give them the satisfaction." Gudrun looked up at him.
"Why not?"
"The east is very strict," Horst said carefully. "If you were born there, you would probably be a farm wife. You would live and die on the farms while the menfolk go off to war or man the ramparts against terrorists. There's very little to do beyond working on the farms. I was lucky, very lucky, that I was able to sit for the exams."
"I know," Gudrun said.
"I might be expected to marry two women," Horst said, "or more. I knew men who had three or four wives, women who'd been married before, only to have their husbands killed on deployment. I'd bring up a flock of children and watch the girls marry soldiers and the boys march off to war. And heaven help anyone who asked questions."
"You make it sound awful,"
Gudrun said, after a moment. "It does have some compensations," Horst admitted. What he'd said was true enough, but incomplete. "People are more connected in the East, Gudrun. Everyone knows everyone else. You know who you can rely on in the settlements, who you can trust with a gun at your back. And the SS is much less overbearing in the East, even though it is far more numerous. But I wouldn't want to spend the rest of my life there." He cleared his throat. "Why do you ask?"
"My father spoke to me yesterday,"
Gudrun said slowly.
"He wants me to marry soon, to choose someone, even though Conrad is still alive. I wanted to know if you face the same pressure."
"I do," Horst admitted. "But it's a little different for me."
"They don't seem to nag Kurt to marry," Gudrun said. "It isn't fair."
"Kurt's a young officer," Horst pointed out. "He might be in a position to marry a girl with excellent family connections." Gudrun shook her head.
"I don't know how long I can keep putting it off," she said, reluctantly. "It could turn nasty if Father finds someone for me."
"Say you need at least 6 months to mourn Conrad," Horst said. Part of him was tempted to push his luck, but it would only make her hate him. "As far as they know, you only just found out what happened to him. After that, you can start looking for someone suitable and promise to let your father offer suggestions if you don't find someone within a year."
Gudrun blinked. "A year?"
"We may be arrested and brutally executed tomorrow," Horst said. Maybe, after 6 months had passed, he'd feel better about courting Gudrun himself. "Or we may win. Or the horse may even learn to sing."
"My father's singing is a deadly weapon," Gudrun said wryly.
"And if that isn't enough, find someone willing to pretend to be your boyfriend," Horst added after a moment. "They'll understand you rejecting someone after a few weeks of casual courting." He glanced at his watch, then rose. "I have a lecture in 10 minutes, he said. He watched as she rose and unplugged the jukebox. "I'll see you later."
"You too,"
Gudrun said. Chapter 25. Reichstag, Berlin. 8 August, 1985. Hans Kruger wrinkled his nose as he stepped into the council chamber and took his seat at one side of the table, facing the Reichsführer SS. Several ministers and military officers were smoking, a sure sign of their agitation, while the Führer was looking around as if he thought he was actually expected to direct the meeting. Hans gave Adolf Bormann a nasty look, then eyed the Reichsführer SS. Karl Holliston had called the meeting and, judging by the papers in front of him, It was going to be a long one.
"The meeting is now called to order," Holliston said, taking control as soon as the last counselor was in his seat. "Heil Hitler!"
"Heil Hitler," the counselors said in unison. Holliston didn't give anyone else a chance to override his control of the meeting.
"It's spreading," he said simply. "Our failure to put a stop to this right from the start," he threw Hans a nasty look, "has encouraged others to defy the Reich."
"You speak of the trade unions," Hans said calmly. Someone had to be the voice of reason at the table. "Or is there something I've missed?"
"The trade unions are not the only problem," Holliston snapped. "There are hundreds of little groups springing up everywhere, discussing the leaflets and comparing notes. We have this piece of shit,"
he took one of the papers from the table and waved it in the air,
"to tell us just what imprudent demands these Valkyries demand."
"The choosers of the slain," Hans mused as he took the sheet of paper. "Odd choice of name for a dissident group."
"It's a deliberate insult," Holliston thundered. "Something must be done."
"We know who the ringleaders are, at least in the factories," Luther Stresemann said.
The head of the Economic Intelligence Service leaned forward.
"We could round them up and arrest them, or simply order them fired."
"The problem isn't that simple," Hans warned. "Each of these ringleaders is a symptom, not the disease itself. We are pushing our industrial base to the limit, and our trained workers are finally pushing back."
"Forming a union without government permission is flatly illegal," Holliston sneered.
Hans would have privately bet good money that Holliston was feeling the heat from industrialists who were closely connected to the SS.
"Every member of each and every union should be thrown into the camps."
Hans resisted, barely, the temptation to sneer back.
"You are talking about arresting 2/3 of our trained workforce," he said. "Good luck getting the damned Gastarbeiters to run a modern manufacturing plant."
"The Gastarbeiters are not permitted to do more than dig ditches and plant crops," Holliston pointed out. "Such jobs are reserved for good Germans."
"Yes, the Germans you're talking about throwing into the camps," Hans said.
Holliston was right. The training for industrial jobs was reserved solely for Germans, although a handful of non-German Aryans might be allowed to join if they showed promise.
"You put even 1/10 of our total workforce out of work, and our economy will go straight into the shitter."
Holliston took a moment to gather himself.
"We cannot allow them to defy the government like this," he said in a markedly calmer tone. "And that set of demands,"
he jabbed a finger at the paper in front of Hans,
"is unthinkable."
Hans looked at the paper and was tempted to agree. Some of the demands were reasonable. He would happily have agreed to end the war in South Africa if he could, while others were impossible to grant without undermining the Reich beyond hope of repair. The whole concept of free elections was absurd. It wouldn't be long before the population started electing politicians based on who could make the best promises, not on practical matters like experience, understanding, and common sense.
"And we cannot act against them openly either," he said. "If even the most optimistic report is accurate, Reichsführer, word is spreading too far too fast. The unions can bring the country to a halt just by going on strike."
"Then we clobber them," Holliston snapped.
"And who will run the industries afterwards?" Hans snapped back. "We're going in circles."
"This is all your fault," Holliston said, "bringing in American ideals."
"We had an industry before the start of the war," Hans pointed out smoothly. "Those panzer tanks that smashed Poland, Denmark, France, and Russia didn't just spring into existence, you know. And we had to do whatever we needed to do to keep up with the Americans. A Panzer III wouldn't last 2 seconds on a battlefield facing the latest American tank."
He took a breath. "This situation has gotten badly out of hand," he said. "Right now, our falsehoods about the war have been exposed, and so the population no longer trusts us. They are forming private groups and discussing discrepancies based on our words and reality. It will not take them long to find other times when we lied to them.
For their own good, Holliston said.
Hans met his eyes. We tell ourselves that, he said, although he doubted it was true in Holliston's case. But I don't think they agree with us.
I will not see us going all the way back to the days when Germany was stabbed in the back by the Jews and Americans and stamped into the ground by the French and British, Holliston said. And I will not hand power over to a bunch of anarchists who don't have the faintest idea of how to form a government, let alone make the hard decisions.
So tell me, Hans said, what do we do? He looked around the table, silently trying to gauge support. So far, most of the other counselors were content to watch and wait for a clear victor to emerge, or to see who would make the best offer for their support. It was frustrating, but in some ways it was almost a relief. At least he'd be able to make his case without being interrupted or shouted down.
The French were supposed to pay us their tribute on the first of the month, he said, after a moment. That tribute has been grossly reduced because the French are having their own labor problems. The stockpiles of food and raw materials they were also supposed to be sending to the Reich have also been delayed.
Send in the troops, Holliston offered.
Take the foodstuffs by force, then lay waste to the field to teach them a lesson.
Hans chose not to respond directly.
Because of that, we have a cash shortfall, he added,
wondering how many of them would understand.
We've been sailing too close to bankruptcy for years. Now, without the French cash, we may well cross the line and find ourselves faced with massive, painful budget cuts. We simply have too many commitments and not enough cash to meet them. For example, we owe the Americans millions of dollars, not Reichmarks, for our recent purchases.
So, we delayed paying, Holliston said.
And so they delay supply, Hans said. The Americans are not the French, Herr Reichsfuhrer. They will not accept the promissory note drawn on a bank they know to be failing. Worse, perhaps, they will not supply us with anything else until they are paid in full.
We don't need anything they can send us, Holliston insisted.
That's not the only problem, Hans continued. Where do we make our budget cuts? The military? The war? The support payments we make to mothers with more than two children? Or the pensions we grant to veterans?
There was a long pause.
We could cut back on our purchase of war materials,
Holliston mused finally.
We don't need more tanks.
But we do need vehicles designed for counterinsurgency operations in South Africa,
Field Marshal Gunter Voss snapped.
We spent years building up the largest tank force in the world, which is next to completely useless in South Africa.
And we can't stop making payments to veterans, Field Marshal Justus Stoffregen added, coldly.
We made them promises.
Which we haven't been keeping for a long time, Hans thought. There had been a commitment, an honorable commitment, to look after the dead and wounded. But that commitment had been broken in South Africa. Trust in the government, never high at the best of times, was almost certainly gone. But there will be riots if we start cutting the support payments. Hans tapped the table.
We can cancel some of our long-term procurement, he said. The planned sixth carrier can be placed on hold if necessary.
He ignored the squawk from Grossadmiral Caius Becker.
And we can scrap the planned development and purchase of a replacement main battle tank. We already have more than enough nuclear missiles to give the American ABM system a very hard time indeed if it comes down to total war, and the Americans are unlikely to launch an invasion of the continent. Our security is unlikely to be put at risk.
The problem, however, is that this will have dangerous knock-on effects, he added, wondering just how many of them would understand.
If we stop paying for new tanks,
We would have more money,
Holliston snapped. Yes, and the corporations we would be paying wouldn't, Hans said. They would wind up with a cash shortfall, so they would either have to cut wages, again, or sack hundreds of trained workers, and that will cause more social unrest at the worst possible time.
They could go east, Holliston offered. We need more farmers.
There's no shortage of farmers, Hans snapped. They're trained and experienced industrial workers. We cannot afford to lose them. He looked down at the table. But even if we do, it will not fix the hole in our budget, he warned. The really big expenses are the ones we don't dare risk cutting. Keeping the garrisons in position to monitor the French alone is quite costly. Keeping Germany south a going concern is staggeringly expensive. And the support payments may be the single worst item on the list. We have got to stop handing out money to every woman who has more than a single child.
But we need to keep our population from decaying, Holliston insisted. How will the women have children if they cannot afford to keep them?
Our population is not in danger of falling, Hans said. It wasn't entirely true, he knew. Industrial societies, and Germany Prime was an industrial society, had significantly lower birth rates than farming societies. America had had a baby boom after the war with Japan, then the birth rate had dropped sharply over the following decades. The Reich had escaped the same fate through passing laws that made it easier to afford more children, both through support payments and public honors for women with many children. But now, simply paying the women their monthly allowance was a major strain on the public purse. Who knew what would happen, apart from massive civil unrest, if the payments were ever cut?
The Untermenschen breed like rabbits, Holliston said. We have to keep up with them.
The Untermenschen are unlikely to pose a major danger, at least for the foreseeable future, Hans countered. Our current problems lie with the so-called Valkyries.
The corporations will not allow any independent trade unions, Friedrich Leopoldsberger said, coldly.
The industry's minister was their creature, Hans knew. The Ministry of Industry was, perhaps, the most deeply corrupt ministry in the Reich. There are corporate-sponsored unions to handle the workers and their concerns.
Unions which do nothing more than identify and marginalize troublemakers, Hans pointed out. Can the corporations afford to lose half of their workforce?
They will come crawling back after a couple weeks of unemployment, Leopoldsberger said. Let them experience life without a regular salary. Let them see what it is like to be without money, without hope of employment. Where else can they go?
That would work, Holliston said.
And how long would it be, Hans asked, before the entire workforce goes on strike? He scowled at Leopoldsberger, who scowled back.
You're thinking in terms of a handful of little men, he said. And yes, a handful of bad apples can be isolated and kicked out of the bunch, but thousands of workers, all of whom are already feeling the pinch? You might just start a whole series of strikes if you sack them, and if that happens, you will find it impossible not to surrender. There are no replacements for trained workers.
We could train others, Leopoldsberger pointed out.
In time? Hans asked. God knows our training system has been having problems, too. Are you planning to bring in the military to run the plants?
We couldn't, Voss said.
We could at least try to break their morale, Holliston said. If they resist, we are no worse off than we already are.
We'd have allowed them to see their strength, Hans said, exasperated. And that will undermine us more than the financial crisis. He gave Holliston a long, considering look. It may be time to start considering other ways to save money and put the Reich on a firmer footing, he added. Perhaps it is time to bring the war in South Africa to an end.
Out of the question,
Holliston thundered.
If we leave, Pretoria will go under and the niggers will rule South Africa, and then Germany south will fall, and then the French, Italian, and Spanish empires will fall, and then there will be a black tide washing at the southern coastline of Europe.
It's rather more likely that they'll have a civil war, Stresemann said. The blacks are split into multiple different factions. Several of them are centered around tribes that are only working together because they see the Afrikaners as a worse threat. If the war comes to an end, if they win their freedom, they might start killing each other instead of threatening our borders.
The black population of Germany south will take heart from our surrender,
Holliston insisted.
And it will be a surrender. Adolf Hitler himself insisted that not one jot of German land was to be surrendered to the barbarians.
Hitler did understand the value of a tactical withdrawal, Stoffregen reminded him. It isn't as if the land won't be recaptured one day.
This isn't a limited tactical withdrawal to buy time,
Holliston said coldly. He held up a hand before any of the military officers could correct him.
I know. We often fell back when the Russians lunged at us during the war, just to allow their advance time to stall before we counterattacked and retook the territory, destroying their forces as we advanced. But here, we would be abandoning a government that shares our ideals. Our enemies will not hesitate to take notice. Vichy France is already under pressure from its own people. If we abandon South Africa, the French will assume that we will abandon the Vichy government and rise up against it, forcing us to intervene. The war in South Africa may be bad, but it will be far worse if we have to fight an insurgency in the south of France. Fighting will spill over into our territories and the results will be disastrous, and Spain, Italy, and Greece will go the same way. To surrender South Africa risks surrendering the entire Reich. And the Americans will not hesitate to take advantage of our weakness. They will ship weapons into France, allowing the French to shoot down our aircraft and destroy our tanks. They may even slip weapons into Germany itself, passing them on to the Gastarbeiters in their camps. We cannot give up now, or we will lose everything.
So we go in a circle, Hans thought. We cannot arrest the rebels, nor can we grant their demands. What the hell do we do?
We use pressure to convince the trade unionists to give up,
Holliston said.
And we pull out all the stops in searching for this Zigrun. We launch a full-scale propaganda campaign to convince the population that the Valkyries will eventually lead Germany to its doom. We make it damn clear that the war in South Africa is necessary.
That would force us to admit that we underestimated the situation, Hans pointed out smoothly.
Then let us make that admission,
Holliston snapped.
Let us admit to the mistake. Let us put our justification in front of the people and let the true Germans see what has to be done.
Hans frowned. And if they reject the arguments?
We control the mass media, Holliston said. The Valkyries have to sneak around the computer network and leave their damnable leaflets in libraries or hidden under seats on the trains. We've even arrested a couple of idiots carting them around the city. They cannot compete with us when it comes to speaking to the people.
And yet the people are more likely to believe them, Hans said. We were caught lying, Karl. It's hard to regain trust when you lose it so roughly.
Then we tell them why we lied,
Holliston said,
because there's no other way to tackle the problem.
Hans sighed inwardly as the councillors started to vote. Holliston, damned the man, had offered them an alternative to either making massive budget cuts or surrendering some of their power. They believed him because they wanted to believe him, because they hoped there was a way out of this crisis without tearing the Reich apart. And nothing he could say would make a difference. He cursed under his breath as Holliston flashed him a look of triumph once the voting was over. Who knew? Maybe Holliston was right. But the figures didn't lie. No matter how he looked at it, there was no way to avoid a major budgetary crisis forever. Indeed, he suspected the crisis would be impossible to hide in less than a month. and who knew what would happen then. Chapter 26. Berlin, Germany. 12 August, 1985. The manager wants to see you, the secretary said curtly as Volker Schulze entered the factory. You ought to go straight to him. No detours along the way. Volker Schulze nodded. He'd expected to be hauled up in front of the factory's manager sooner rather than later. Indeed, he was surprised it hadn't already happened. There was always some ass-licking bastard waiting to rat out his fellows for money or a chance at promotion. But given the sheer number of workers in the new union and the rumors spreading through the grapevine, he suspected that management was passing the buck higher and higher up the chain. The manager of the factory couldn't even muster the initiative to wipe his own ass without orders in triplicate from his superiors. "I'll be along in a moment," he said. His eyes found Joachim as he entered the factory and gave him a significant look. They'd had a week to come up with contingency plans for when management finally decided to do something about the union, and they were, he suspected, about to find out just how good they were.
"I'll have to leave my coat in the cloakroom."
"Now," the secretary said. Someone must have bawled him out for his role in helping to arrange the first union meeting, even though he hadn't had the slightest idea what had actually been going on. Volker Schulze would have felt sorry for him if the secretary hadn't been such a pissy little man. "The manager wants to see you at once." Volker Schulze mouthed orders at Joachim, then turned and allowed the secretary to lead him up the stairs to the management offices. He'd only entered them twice before, back when he'd been a loyal foreman. He'd had to defend two workers who'd been on the verge of being fired for problems beyond their control. He couldn't help feeling a flicker of doubt as he passed through a solid wooden door that was normally locked, even though he'd made his plans and discussed them with his wife. If he'd misjudged the situation, and he knew all too well just how ruthless the government could be, he was in deep trouble. "They can't afford to punish all of us," he reassured himself. A week had given him time to spread the idea of independent unions far and wide. His was still the best organized, but others were growing in size and power. "They need us to man the factories and produce their guns and butter." "Wait here," the secretary said. Volker Schulze snorted rudely as he leaned against the wall. It was intimidation, childish intimidation. It might work on a young boy who'd been kicked out of class and told to report to the headmaster, but not on a grown man with genuine combat experience. The secretary had none, as far as he knew. He'd been too cowardly to volunteer for military service, and lucky enough to escape conscription. And he would be surprised if his managers had any experience themselves. He'd be more worried if he was getting called for an interview with his former CO. He was midway through a silent recitation of SS Adolf Hitler's battle honors when the secretary returned, looking as if someone had crammed a rod up his butt. Volker kept his face under control as the secretary motioned for him to step through the door into the manager's office. Not entirely to his surprise, he noticed as he entered, the factory manager was absent, his place taken by two men in fancy suits. He recognized one of them as a senior official within the factory's parent corporation. There had been an article on him in the corporate newsletter, but the other was a complete stranger.
"Foreman Volker Schulze," the official said.
Volker had to think hard to recall the man's name.
Leonhard Cross, if he recalled correctly.
"You have formed a union in defiance of both your contract with the corporation and Reich law. Do you have anything you wish to say in your defense?"
"Yes, sir," Volker said.
He adjusted his posture, trying hard to present a picture of a man who was both willing to compromise and yet determined to stand his ground.
"The current working conditions are appalling, and they're only going to get worse. There have already been a number of deaths over the last 2 months caused by increased demand for production combined with poor maintenance. We simply cannot go on like this.
It was worse than that, he knew. Four men had died only 2 months ago, after the piece of machinery they were working on had exploded. That had been bad enough, but their families, unfortunate enough to live on corporate property, had been immediately evicted on the grounds that their relatives no longer worked at the plant. In hindsight, Volker suspected, they should have taken that incident as an excuse to form an independent union. There had been so much anger on the factory floor that it would have been easy to start a strike.
"Your conduct is inexcusable," Cross said.
If he'd heard a single word Volker had said, he didn't give any sign of it.
"You are accordingly dismissed from your job. Your appeal has already been reviewed by the Labor Commission and rejected. You will be escorted to the gates and evicted. As you have admitted to forming an unregulated union, you will not be paid your final paycheck."
Volker kept his face expressionless. He hadn't expected anything else. The appeal he hadn't even made, was nothing more than a mere formality, a meaningless statement designed to suggest that there had been a form of due process. He could have put forward any excuse, he knew, and they would have rejected it. Forming a union, challenging the corporate managers directly, it was an unforgivable sin. But it was far too late for them to crush the union by firing its founder. The union was already out of control. He glanced behind him as the door opened, just in time to see two burly men step into the chamber. "Corporate security," he noted dispassionately. They carried themselves like thugs, not real soldiers. He offered no resistance as they grabbed his shoulders, spun him around, and marched him through the door. The secretary, standing outside, sneered at Volker as he was pushed through the outer office and down the stairs. A number of workers were waiting at the bottom. Volker smiled to himself as the security guards hesitated, suddenly unsure of themselves. They were good at pushing individuals around, but they didn't have the bravery to face an entire group.
"Strike!" Volker announced loudly. "Strike!"
He yanked his hands free as the workers swarmed forwards. Joachim had already briefed them, he knew. The guards had no time to resist before they were grabbed, searched, and shoved into an office to wait until they were released. They made no attempt to draw their pistols and fight back before it was too late. Volker took one of the pistols and checked it. He dreaded to think what his training officers would have said if they'd seen the weapon, and then started to bark orders. The unionists took up the cry of strike, sending advance parties running through the factory. Volker himself turned and led another team back up the stairs into the outer office. The secretary, no longer sneering, had scooped up a telephone and was frantically dialing a number. Volker resisted the temptation to shoot the device out of his hand. He honestly wasn't sure if the pistol would fire when he pulled the trigger, and instead motioned for the secretary to put the telephone down.
"Wimp,"
Joachim commented, as Volker motioned for the secretary to stand up and move away from his desk. His trousers were stained with urine. "Honestly, he should try working on the shop floor." Volker wrinkled his nose in disgust. He'd pissed himself, too, the first time he'd gone into battle. But he'd been up against a serious enemy. They'd known what would happen if they were captured by the Arabs, and every man in the unit had privately resolved to save one bullet for themselves, rather than fall into enemy hands. The secretary, as priggish as he was, had nothing to fear as long as he behaved himself. But then, he probably thought the workers on the factory floor were barbarians. He'd certainly never spent any time with them.
"Keep an eye on him," he ordered, as he led the way into the inner office.
He snorted in annoyance as his eyes swept the fancy office. He'd hoped to capture the managers, but their chamber was already deserted. They'd sneaked down the rear stairs to the loading bay and probably run into the streets. It might not be a bad thing, The government might feel less inclined to negotiate if there were hostages in the factory, but it was still annoying. He'd been looking forward to the chance to show Cross just how it felt to be at another's mercy.
"The factory is ours," another worker reported as they made their way back to the lower levels. "Most of the workers have joined us."
"Tell anyone who wants to leave now that they can go," Walker ordered.
There was no point in trying to keep the secretary and the rest of the administrative staff. Besides, there was too great a chance of someone beating hell out of the bureaucrats and making it harder for the workers to come to a peaceful settlement.
"And round up a handful of volunteers to deliver messages."
Joachim gave him a sharp look.
"We need to spark off other strikes, don't we?"
Walker nodded. A single factory had a mere 3,000 workers, most of whom had either joined the union when it was announced or would join now that the union had proven itself capable of effective action. But they really needed the other factories to go on strike too, or the government would isolate them, seal off their lines of supply, and wait for the strikers to starve. It didn't seem to have occurred to them, yet, that mistreating trained and proud men might not be a wise idea.
"Yeah," he said. "Put it out on the computer network, then start making telephone calls before they cut the lines. We need the strike to spread as widely as possible."
"And hope that Gerda and Liana get out of easy reach," he added mentally. The strikers had planned as best as they could, but no battle plan ever survived contact with the enemy. If he was in the RSHA, he'd try to bring pressure to bear on the families of the strikers. If they don't get into hiding in time, they may be arrested. Gudrun had never really liked eating meals at school. Every student was served the same meal, and the teachers were quite happy to punish anyone who failed to eat every last bite. But she rather enjoyed eating in the university cafeteria. There was a wide selection of choices. Tables and chairs were scattered everywhere instead of being placed in neat little rows, while students could sit anywhere they wanted, rather than being tied to a specific chair for their entire year. Just being allowed to choose her own food, instead of choking down something that smelled suspiciously like manure, was enough to make her actually enjoy herself.
"They say university fees are going to rise," Hartwig was saying loudly.
He was a year older than Gudrun, a blonde boy with a reputation for chasing women as well as scoring high marks in all of his classes. She would have liked him if he hadn't been loud and boastful, as well as intelligent.
"We may have to start paying to attend."
She smiled inwardly as she ate her meal. That was one of the rumors the Valkyries had started, a suggestion that the students would soon have to actually pay to attend the university. It was a terrifying thought. Of all the students she knew, only Hilda's family was wealthy enough to afford the prospective fees. Three-quarters of the student body would have to leave if they found themselves being charged to attend.
"That's outrageous," Lynn said.
She was Hartwig's current girlfriend, a girl as blonde as Hartwig or Gudrun herself. Gudrun sometimes wondered if she had paid someone to take her exams, because she seemed to lose half her IQ whenever Hartwig smiled at her.
"I couldn't afford to attend."
Idiots, Gudrun thought. One of the spies wasn't too far away, listening intently. Hartwig and Lynn might find themselves in trouble if the spies couldn't find anyone more significant. Or was Hartwig's family important enough to escape the consequences of their son having a big mouth and no brain cells?
"You'll get yourselves in hot water."
She glanced up sharply as Tomas charged into the cafeteria.
"There's a strike," he bellowed, as everyone turned to look at him. "The workers are going on strike."
Gudrun listened, surprised, as he babbled out an explanation. 7 factories had gone on strike? How many workers had believed the rumors the Valkyries had started? And how many more would go on strike before the affair came to an end? And what would the government do?
"We have to go help them," Hartwig said.
He rose.
"Come on."
Gudrun hesitated.
The spy had already started to hurry towards the edge of the room, clearly planning to find a telephone and alert his superiors. And not every student looked enthusiastic about leaving the campus and hurrying down to the factories before it was too late. But Hartwig was drawing dozens of students in his wake, pointing out that the government would never dare harm young men and women. Gudrun hoped, as she rose to follow him, that he was right. She jumped as a hand caught her arm.
"You shouldn't be going," Horst muttered. "Gudrun."
Cold logic told her he was right. She'd started the Valkyries. She'd started the rumors and proclamations that had probably helped spark off the strike. If there was a riot, if she was arrested or killed, the entire movement might fall apart. And yet, she couldn't let her fellow students and the strikers go into danger alone. She owed it to her conscience to share the same risks.
"I have to go," she muttered back, confident that the student babble would make it hard for any listening ears to overhear. "Tell Sven to start sending out messages, encouraging others to join the strike."
Horst gave her a worried look.
"I can go with you."
"Don't,"
Gudrun said. She brushed off his arm and turned towards the door. It was a risk, but it was one she had to take.
"We can't both be caught."
"There's a what? A strike,"
Holliston said with heavy satisfaction. Hans couldn't help wondering what he was so pleased about, not when he would have bet good money that Holliston's policy had started the strike in the first place.
12 factories have gone on strike so far, and rumors are spreading across the entire city.
Hans swore under his breath as Holliston outlined the situation. There was no time to check with his own sources, no time to do anything but rely on the Reichsführer SS's version of the tale. He doubted Holliston would actually lie to the Reich Council. His career wouldn't survive a deliberate lie. Yet, he would definitely paint the situation as darkly as possible. A strike, right in the heart of Berlin.
"You tried to fire someone for forming a union," he said, when Holliston had finished, "and that led to an immediate strike."
He groaned as the full implications struck him. Attacking the striking workers would weaken the economy at the worst possible time. But conceding their demands would be even worse, as Holliston's corporate allies had probably already pointed out. The strikers would be emboldened. They'd demand more and more until they hit something the Reich literally could not give them. And then? The Reich would not be in good position to put a stop to the whole affair.
"We have to take action,"
Holliston said curtly.
"I have 2 battalions of military police on alert, ready to handle the strikers."
"So you do," Hans said. "And then what?"
"We move in, arrest the strikers, and then dictate terms from a position of strength,"
Holliston insisted firmly.
"They're breaking the law by forming an independent union."
"Yes, I know," Hans said. "And are you going to arrest all of them?"
"The ringleaders will be executed,"
Holliston said.
He thumped the table with his fist.
"And the others will go back to work."
Hans glared at him.
"And what if they don't?"
"Then we'd hardly be in our worst position,"
Holliston snapped. He looked up, his gaze skimming around the table.
"I call for a vote. Do we send in the police, or try to negotiate with lawbreakers? We cannot allow the strikes to spread."
"They will," Hans said.
He forced himself to keep his voice calm.
"There's a saying I heard from my son, who went to work in China," he said.
Helping the Chinese nationalists build up their industrial base might have been a mistake in hindsight. China might pose a threat to Germany East in the next few decades.
"There was a Chinese ruler who punished everything with death. One day, a bunch of men discovered that they were late for work. If they arrived, they would be executed. But the punishment for revolting against the ruler was also death. What did they have to lose?"
"We cannot let lawbreakers get away with it,"
Holliston said.
I call for a vote.
Hans sighed. Put like that, the result was a foregone conclusion. The strike would be brutally crushed, and the strikers would be arrested. And then? He kept his face impassive. It might be time to start coming up with some contingency plans of his own.
Chapter 27. Berlin, Germany. 12 August, 1985. Hermann stared at the captain.
They want us to do what?
Seal off the factory district, the captain ordered. There's a strike, apparently, and friends and family of the strikers are hurrying to their side.
A strike,
Hermann repeated. He shook his head in disbelief. There were no strikes in the Reich. The French might strike at the drop of a hat. He'd heard stories about French workers downing tools because someone had said an unkind word. But the German worker was made of sterner stuff. And besides, strikes were illegal. The workers might wind up being dispatched to one of the less comfortable settlements in Germany East, if they were lucky. The captain ignored him.
I want barricades set up here, here, and here, he said, tapping a number of road intersections. If anyone tries to get past you and into the sealed zone, turn them back. If they are persistent, arrest them, and we'll process them later. Anyone trying to get out of the sealed zone is to be arrested. These are German citizens, so use the minimum necessary force, consistent with your personal safety.
Shit, Hermann muttered. Caius stuck up a hand.
Sir, who's going to assist the strikers?
The friends and families, the captain said, in some irritation. He hated repeating himself, and apparently some students from the university. Turn them back. Arrest them if they won't go. Hermann swallowed. Students from the university? Could Gudrun be going? He hoped not. She wouldn't be sitting down for a week if he caught her trying to bring aid and comfort to the strikers. But she'd certainly have friends and fellow students heading to the sealed zone. If he'd had time, he would have called the university and ordered Gudrun to go home at once. Yet he knew the captain would never allow it. His superiors would be breathing down his neck, ordering the police to get into position before the situation got completely out of hand. If it isn't already, he thought, as he hastily donned riot gear and readied himself as best he could. They were trained in handling criminals and Untermensch who rioted in the streets, but they'd had very little training in handling civilian rioters gently. If they've planned for a riot, they'll be ready for the gas and water cannons. He pushed the thought aside as he hurried down to the vans, following the rest of the policemen. Caius held the door open for him, then slammed it closed and barked orders to the driver, who started the engine and drove the vehicle out of the parking lot. Hermann winced as the howl of the sirens echoed through the air, warning civilian traffic to get out of the way. He hoped, prayed, that the radio would be telling civilians to go home and stay there. If they were lucky, perhaps the strikers would see sense when they saw the police setting up barricades. They're committed, he thought grimly. He'd always hated trying to arrest criminals who knew there was no hope of escaping a life sentence to the camps, or death. They simply had nothing to lose. Why not try to kill a policeman so they'd have company in hell? They're striking, and striking is illegal. It was an unpleasant thought. Conrad's father, he rather liked the man, even though he'd gone straight into civilian life rather than serving as a policeman, was an experienced military officer, while many of the strikers would have at least some military experience. They might even have weapons. Retired soldiers and SS stormtroopers were often quietly allowed to keep their personal weapons, and they wouldn't back down at the slightest hint of trouble. Indeed, some of them would be very well versed in ways to use the terrain and improvised weapons to their advantage. Berlin might be turned into a battleground. The driver clicked on the radio.
"Is an emergency announcement," a grim-sounding speaker said. "All civilians are ordered to remain in their homes or workplaces until further notice. I say again, all civilians are ordered to remain in their homes or workplaces until further notice. If you are on the roads,
pull over, and remain there until further notice. I say again.
Nice speech, Fritz said sarcastically. Do you think anyone will listen?
Hermann shrugged as the driver pulled up at their destination. It had been a decade since the last nuclear attack drill, when the Reich-wide emergency broadcasting system had been tested. Few civilians would know what to do if all hell broke loose, let alone a riot in Berlin or an American attack. It was possible that most people would obey orders, but if even 10% of the city's population failed to obey orders... He gritted his teeth and followed the rest of the policemen out of the van. Civilians were scattering in all directions, some clearly trying to get out of the sealed zone and others trying to sneak in. The policemen ignored the civilians until they had the barricades firmly in place, then started warning intruders to turn back. Thankfully, most of the civilians trying to get into the sealed zone seemed willing to obey orders. It was the ones trying to leave who caused the worst problems. Half of them seemed convinced they were so important that, instead of trying to arrest them, the police should drive them immediately to the Reichstag. And some of them probably are important, Hermann thought, as the number of handcuffed prisoners started to rise sharply. But we don't know how to tell the difference. Reichsfuhrer SS Karl Holliston was angry, and he didn't care who knew it. Report after report was coming into the RSHA, warning him that the government was on the verge of losing control of the industrial zone. Thousands of civilians were even trying to support the strikers, despite increasingly harsh emergency broadcasts. The treachery had sunk so deeply into the Reich that even the corporate managers, the men who'd been first in line to demand immediate action, were hesitating. He glared down at the map, silently considering how best to proceed. Attacking the factories themselves was dangerous as hell. Hans Kruger and his cronies would make a terrible fuss if pieces of expensive machinery were destroyed, but the marchers in the streets could be handled without risking serious trouble. Who cared if a few hundred idiots got banged up by the military police? And the prospect of teaching some of the students... He knew several dozen had managed to get into the industrial sector before the police had set up barricades. A sharp lesson was delightful. Hans Kruger would have to work overtime to come up with excuses after the little bastards were caught in the act. Herr Reichsfuhrer, Karl allowed himself a tight smile as he looked up.
Clear the streets.
Andrew, Clyde Marshall said, are you sure we're safe here? Andrew shrugged. I wouldn't count on it, he said after a moment. But I do think we're reasonably safe here. He smiled at Marshall's expression. The Reich hadn't quite figured out that he was a reporter rather than a press attaché, or that he'd happily accompany Andrew into the teeth of possible danger. There hadn't been any real trouble in Berlin since the 60s, as far as anyone knew. The growing mass of workers, students, and civilians was unprecedented within the Reich. Thankfully, unlike some of the uglier riots in the U.S., it seemed to be reasonably peaceful. Keep taking and uploading photographs, he ordered, instead of adding more empty reassurances. They'll probably smash the camera if they arrest us. That girl looks very photogenic, Marshall agreed. A young girl, she couldn't have been older than 18, was perched on top of a burly worker, waving her shirt in the air, her breasts wobbling dangerously in her bra. What keeps that bra on, do you think? The eyes of every young man in the vicinity, Andrew said. But she isn't the most important person here. He couldn't help feeling a flicker of sympathy for the girl. It was unlikely she'd be molested, at least by the workers and her fellow students, but she might well be expelled from the university. The Reich had yet to embrace topless protests. Indeed, there were laws against revealing too much flesh in public. Even men were expected to wear knee-length shorts during the hotter months. He frowned inwardly as they made their way down the street. It had been sheer luck and a tip-off from a contact within the Ministry of Industry that had got them into the factory complex before the police arrived and started to seal the whole area off. Andrew honestly wasn't sure what the authorities would do next, particularly if the strikers refused to back down.
and he suspected they couldn't back down. Strikes were illegal after all. The workers were expected to accept whatever their corporate masters saw fit to hand out. And then...
"Don't start taking notes," he warned, as he caught sight of Marshall reaching for his notebook. "They'll just be taken away if we get arrested."
Marshall paled.
"I should have volunteered to go to South Africa instead," he said. "This place is shit."
"Just be glad you don't live here," Andrew muttered. "And that the Reich hasn't yet realized the power of digital cameras," he added silently. "They may arrest us, they may smash the camera, but the photographs will get out. And then?" Gudrun had never enjoyed marching in unison. Not in school, and not in the BDM. It was so rigid, so controlled. Children were punished for stepping out of line, for speeding up, for slowing down, for doing anything other than obeying orders without question. By the time she'd turned 18, she'd been so indoctrinated that it had taken her months to stop walking like a schoolgirl or jumping to attention whenever someone spoke to her in the voice of authority. Individuality was not encouraged. But the protest march outside the factory gates was different. People, workers, students, civilians, milled around, chatting happily as they wandered backwards and forwards. A handful of men were trying to make speeches, and protesters were listening or not, as they chose. There was no compulsion, there was no threat of force. The crowd was brimming with a strange energy, a sense that they were free, that they could do anything. Gudrun knew she should be trying to speak herself, even though it would be far too revealing, but instead, all she wanted to do was enjoy the sensation of acting out as part of a crowd. There were just too many of them to be arrested. And if we'd all stood up to the matrons, she thought, perhaps the BDM would have been more fun. It was a galling thought. She could see, with the advantage of hindsight, just how carefully they'd been indoctrinated into the organization, which had been preparing them to be good little housewives and civilians. Those who had been different, the fat, the questioners, the dissidents, had been separated from the herd, then publicly punished and shamed in front of their peers. No one had wanted to stand up for them and take the risk of being punished, too, even though the matrons would have had problems handling a mass rebellion. "Or they would just have sent us home with notes," she thought sourly. Her parents would have been furious and afraid if she'd stood up to the matrons. Who knew what sort of attention it would muster? And our parents would have punished us for them. She smiled as someone produced a jukebox and plugged it into the factory's power supply, producing an American jazz song that was technically banned. The crowd looked shocked, then laughed. The sense of freedom was almost intoxicating. A dozen students began to dance, some of the girls pulling the male workers onto the streets and into the dance. Gudrun felt a flicker of bitter guilt. She'd only ever danced with Conrad, outside the stiffly formal dances they'd been forced to endure at school, and then pushed it away as a young worker held out a hand, inviting her to dance. Grinning, she took his hand and allowed him to lead her into the swing. It felt as though she was casting off a pair of invisible shackles. "And I am," she thought. "Together, we can do anything." Hermann winced as a line of black vans appeared, driving down the road towards the barricades. The military policemen stopped just outside the roadblocks and scrambled out, brandishing their clubs and shields as they formed up into lines. A trio of armored vehicles followed them, bristling with water cannons. He hoped desperately that the set of tubes on top of the vehicles were designed to launch gas canisters rather than mortars. The crowds within the sealed zone were seemingly unarmed.
"Open the barricades," their CO ordered.
He was a grim-faced man who looked ready to do anything to restore order.
"And stand ready to receive prisoners."
Hermann nodded and hurried to obey. It was hard to see their faces under the black helmets they wore, but it didn't look as though the military policemen were worried about what they were going to do. They looked enthusiastic. It struck him suddenly that they would normally handle captured POWs and their families. German civilians would be a great deal safer than prisoners who knew they were going to the camps.
"This is going to be messy," Caius predicted, as the military policemen marched through the barricade and down towards the factories. "Very messy."
"I know," Hermann said.
He had no sympathy for the strikers, but there were hundreds of innocents caught in the sealed zone.
God help them.